Welcome back to Shattering Mist, the pot calling the kettle black. And this ambassador for the Saudi Arabians wrote, "Those who have adopted the view that Assad's regime's continuation in power is the lesser of two evils should be under no illusion as to what their preferred option is, fascism." By the way, it's to recognize the lesser of two evils does not necessitate a preference. It's just a statement of fact that both Assad and those opposing him are evil, and that the those opposing Assad will be more uncivil, more savage to the population of Syria than was Assad, and they will be more menacing to the countries around Syria than was Assad. That doesn't mean that, or anyone is preferring the evil that is Assad. It's just to say that one ought not provide weapons and support or even speak in favor of either side, and most certainly shouldn't be arming either side. This man concludes his article by writing, "If history is any indication, once a fascist mindset has been integrated into a support base of a regime, peace seldom follows. The quest for vanquishing enemies, both internal and external, never ceases." Well, such is the nature of the very religion that has chosen fascist economic systems and political systems every place that it has poisoned Islam. What do you think, Glenn? Is there any way to differentiate between fascism and Islam in the countries that have a majority Muslim population?
Well, I was thinking about that earlier. It's when I think of fascism in the modern 20th century context, I think of industrial technical powers, and Islam typically doesn't build an economy or build infrastructure, you know, well enough to fit the definition of fascism by, like, a modern industrial technical standard. It may by an older standard just in terms of the control mechanisms you speak of.
There really is nothing in fascism that necessitates industrialized, but that's probably
Nazi
Germany.
Think of fascist nations,
I
think of World War II, Italy and Germany.
Right, of course. Yeah, of course. But the reality is that fascism is a economic and political mindset, simply concentrates control, ownership, and power among the few, and therefore, if you look at an Islamic state where, in most cases, royalty are the beneficiaries. They are the owners. They are the controllers. They are the lords to be worshipped. As a matter of fact, in a couple of these United Arab Emirate spinoffs, now it is a crime punishable by death to say anything insulting of the monarch. So it's pure, just like Nazi Germany. It's a purely fascist control mechanism that permeates Islam. Now, the reason that Islam is not industrialized is because there is no rule of law in Islam, and therefore there's no reason for anyone to invest the time and energy to develop industry. So there is no effective industry in an Islamic country for that very purpose.
Reminds me of the old the BC newspaper cartoon where the disheveled guy would hold up the sign that says the king is a fink. Yeah. you can't even do that. I listened to the SRN news where they said, like, the Western powers were appalled by the goings-on in Ukraine. And I'm like, yeah, okay, it's very simple. Stop subsidizing them, and you won't be so appalled. You know, it's just crazy.
There is no resolution of the Ukrainian situation. I mean, that's the sad thing there. The people came out of the control mechanism that was the USSR. They were used to being cared for and controlled by their government, and they moved into this brave new world of free enterprise, and they couldn't handle it. And so they wanted to continue to be cared for. This whole idea of having to be responsible and make your own decisions was not something that they could handle, and they still have this this raw, immoral strain to them that caused them to be the source of all of those anti-Semitic pogroms during the beginning of the 20th century. And so
they didn't have the necessary diversity of infrastructure or work ethic, or look at the history of the United States that built up it, or look at the history of Europe that allowed for the flowering of the economies, Reformation, Renaissance, infrastructure development, Protestant work ethic. They had none of that. You can't just like dump it on them that quick.
And they failed, and it can't be resolved. So you're either going to have the United States, Europe, or Russia have them as their dependents, because they are dependent still. It's why God doesn't like us to be dependent upon our government. They are dependent, and one of those three has to bail them out to keep them from being in total and complete anarchy. But the issue is that the United States is bankrupt, and we can't do it. The European Union has really no interest in integrating the Ukraine, because they're way too underwater financially. Their debt to GDP ratio is many times the level that the European Union will accept. And so the only country that is willing to and able to is Russia, and Russia is only able to because the primary contributor to the Ukraine's debt is oil imports. And Russia is the sole supplier, so Russia can say, all right, we'll give you oil. It only costs us 25 cents a barrel anyway, to keep the Ukraine from being total anarchy.
Well, as the one commentator is so fond of saying, as long as you have a system whereby the currency is issued as a debt, as a loan at interest, there is less currency in circulation than is owed from the moment the money is issued. So there is no way out except for maybe the Shemitah or Jubilee type thing, wipe the slate and go on. Right. But and plus we have John Kerry running around preventively tongue lashing everybody, and it's like, why don't these people, stood up and told them to go pound sand is basically, of all people, Karzai. Mr. Chevron shill. And he's going to be in trouble because he's doing what Saddam Hussein did and Muammar Gaddafi. He's starting to care about his people and wants to do good things for them. Well, we know what happens to people who grow a conscience when they've been put in these shill positions.
Yeah, I'm not going to give Karzai. I'll give him the first credit for the first thing you said. Karzai is one of the few leaders in the world who's finally said, the United States can't be trusted. The hell with the United States. I am no longer going to be a puppet of the United States. I give him credit for that. But I'm not going to give him credit because he's growing a conscience and trying to take care of his own people. I think he's trying to take care of his own hide, which is the recognition that once the Americans are out, the Taliban, which has already regained about 80% of its power, will regain 100% of its power within a month or two of the departure of U.S. troops. And as a result of that, if Karzai doesn't begin to side with, release Taliban prisoners, begin discussions with the Taliban for their return to power, then he's a dead man. So I think he's recognized that he needs to do it.
He's kind of caught between the suicide bomber and the Barrett 50.
Yes, he is. He's kind of like Stalin's troops and defending Leningrad during the during World War II. If you shot at the Germans, they were going to kill you. And if you retreated, even to get more ammunition, the communists Russians were going to kill you. Yeah, he's not a good man. He is a thief. He is a con artist. He is, as you said, he's a shell of Chevron. But at the time, I think he was actually Unocal, but they've all merged together.
Yeah.
And he was. That's why Bush chose him, is because he came out of the oil business. And Bush originally invaded Afghanistan not because of Al Qaeda, but because he wanted his buddies to be able to get the pipeline they so desired across western Afghanistan, and he didn't like having to negotiate with the Taliban for the rights to put it there. So I felt if we invade Afghanistan, that the American oil companies will be able to work with the Pakistanis to put a pipeline in western Afghanistan. Of course, what they tried to do and build the roads to do it and tried to do it, but you just can't do something like that in an Islamic country, and they gave up.
Right. It's crazy. I am really annoyed with the hypocritical tongue, parental dressing down of Kerry.
Kerry's terrible. He's terrible.
He should be removed from his position as Secretary of State and returned to his old job as butler for the Adams family.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I look at him to. And of course, a lot of people look at him as Lurch. But the reality is that Kerry is amongst the most shrill and hypocritical voices in the world today. And when no matter what country he's talking about, when he's talking about, for example, Saddam Hussein bombing his own people, then what was Lincoln in the Civil War? Are you going to call?
He was a fascist. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Fascist.
I mean, so if you're going to criticize Assad for killing his own people in the midst of a civil war, then what was Abraham Lincoln doing? And why are there shrines in Washington to Abraham Lincoln doing it, and yet you want to tongue lash Assad for doing it?
Well, he didn't exactly put a leash on Sherman. And in the Civil War, you see it's really one of the first ones where you see the doctrine of total war and the devastation of civilian cities and stuff, that sort of thing. So previous to that, even the revolution wasn't conducted according to total war strategy, really,
Right. We fought it under guerrilla strategies as opposed to under conventional war strategies. It was an unpopular war, which is the only way that we could actually propagate it that way.
I mean, but even the Brits and the Hessians didn't devastate cities the way Sherman did.
Correct. That is correct. You know, the American Civil War, which Americans look at Lincoln as the great savior of the country, he actually destroyed what was good about America when he fought that war. It never should have been fought. But the way that the war was finally won is twofold. One is that Ulysses S. Grant, even though he was a drunk, he could count. And he recognized that he could lose every battle and still win the war because the North so outmanned and gunned the South, and that's what he did. So he destroyed the military's the South's military ability to defend itself through attrition. And now the inhuman cost of that, and the fact this man became president, is incalculable. It's no wonder he was an alcoholic. He had to be, because you were sacrificing hundreds of thousands of young people's lives for your political agenda. And second, Sherman's March to the Sea was a terrorist campaign. It was a scorched earth campaign, the very way we fought World War II, where we firebombed German and Japanese cities. Our plan was to make the population unwilling to continue to support the war effort through terrorism. And so that's how America fought World War II, and it's how the Civil War was concluded with Sherman's terrorist march to the sea. We don't teach that in school, so you're unique amongst individuals, Glenn, for not only knowing that, but be willing to say it. We'll return to Shattering Myths. Stay with us. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yoda. You can join this conversation toll-free, 877-300-7645. As we have done over the last couple of weeks, we're going to continue to make our way through the edicts of the Seventh-day Adventists. We're doing this for two reasons. One is that there are 20 million people beguiled by that particular denomination of Christianity. They're 20 million strong, which means there's a lot more of them than there are even Mormons. And second, that most of what they have to say in their edicts are universally upheld by most Christians, most Protestant Christians for sure, and most Christians generally. So the next item on the list, and we still do have Glenn with us, and I've encouraged him to participate. The next item on the list is baptism. Baptism, we confess our faith in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ to testify of our death to sin and our purpose to walk in the newness of life, is their opening statement. You know, if baptism were something that God thought was important, that it was part of one's salvation, don't you think that Yosha would have baptized somebody? You know, he never baptized anyone. Never once. He never even used the word baptism, which is a transliteration of the Greek word. So when he's speaking of immersion in water, he's not referencing a religious act of baptism. He's speaking symbolically of the two roles of water. Now, he explained the role of water when he had his conversation with Nicodemus. Remember, he said, you know, unless you're born both of spirit and of the water, you're not going to inherit the kingdom of heaven. Well, the water birth is our natural birth. We come out of water when we're born. The sac is, the water is broken just before our natural birth. And water is the ultimate solvent. It is a very effective cleanser, and therefore it's used symbolically of being cleansed. It is also the necessary for life. There is no life without water. And so water's role in the continuation of life, water's role as a cleanser, and the idea that we're born materially as a corporeal material being, and then we're reborn spiritually for those who embrace the covenant, is an essence of that teaching. But never once did Yahusha baptize anyone. And so
What about him being baptized by John the Baptist?
Yeah, but even then, the concept of a baptism as practiced by Christians isn't what is going on there.
But ablutions were ubiquitous throughout the
world. Right. Yeah, he walked into the River Jordan. Now, the River Jordan is extraordinarily important because the River Jordan denotes the distinction between the world at large and the Promised Land. And so the children of Israel had to cross through the River Jordan to enter the Promised Land. So he is now this bridge from the world to God's home. And so he stands in the River Jordan as an example of being that bridge. And then he is demonstrating how he and the set-apart spirit collectively work to wash us of our sins, and how they not only provide this symbolism of our material birth, but also of our spiritual birth. And it's why when he was in the water, the dove, which is the symbol of Yahweh's set apart spirit, came upon him. Is the symbolism there is that you're being cleansed by and being born anew by the set apart spirit. So it isn't an act that saves. It is simply a symbolic act that demonstrates our understanding of this profound truth. That's all it is.
Right, right. Now, it's interesting you mentioned the spirit descending upon Yahusha the dove. What about the voice from heaven?
Yahweh proclaimed that as he sent the spirit to down his set apart spirit down upon Yahusha, that this individual represents me. This is my son, and so he is affirming an extraordinarily profound connection here. And by son, Yahweh is presenting himself as father. So they're identifying this relationship of father-son. Now, of course, Yahusha is a corporeal manifestation of Yahweh, diminished and set apart from Yahweh. So he's not a son in the sense of your and my sons being descendants of us. He's not a second-generation deity. More on that in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are beginning to review some of the Seventh-day Adventist edicts shared mostly by all Christians. Baptism is their 15th edict. By baptism, we confess our faith in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Larry, I know you're listening here. If you knew Yahusha, which is his real name, as opposed to the misnomer Jesus, if you knew that he was the work of Yah and Yah saving us, not the Christ being used here as a last name, and it's not a name, it's not even an accurate title. If you knew that God didn't die and cannot die, if you knew, in fact, there was no bodily resurrection, then faith would be counterproductive, and even if these things were true, faith would be the opposite of knowing. So why would one confess one's faith? If you have faith, it means you don't know.
Well, what I'd like to point out here is that, you know, we're to look at the Torah for these things.
Of course.
And Abraham didn't believe in God.
He knew him. He knew him.
He talked with him. He walked with him. And he decided to trust him after knowing him.
Yeah, let me ask the question to you, Larry. Do you believe God? Do you have faith in God, or do you know him?
I know him. It isn't a question of do I believe in God. That is a pointless issue.
Right.
The issue is whether or not I can trust and rely on him out of knowledge. And
right.
I do have an understanding and knowledge.
Yeah, you've chosen to trust and rely on him because you've invested the time, you prioritized what he had to say, and you've come to the point that you have chosen to trust and rely upon what he is offering because you've made that transition from knowing him to understanding what he was offering and put you in a very powerful position. It's what I tell people. Like this morning I had an interview on Mancow's show where he's opposed to organized religion. He knows there's something really troubling about organized Christianity and about Paul, but you know, he's not to the point where he knows
faith,
right. So he's still in the realm of faith. And what I told him, as I said, I know this sounds scary. That what I'm doing here is I'm pulling the rug out from underneath your religion, and that might sound a bit scary. But I'm going to tell you that what you find when you give up religion in terms of a relationship with God is so vastly superior. But I'm really not taking anything from you and giving you some, offering you something that is vastly more rewarding.
Yeah, I would add this. Yahweh, 100% of the time, opposes religion.
Yes.
Yahusha railed against religion.
And by the way, Mancow recognized that. He says, yeah, I recognize that. Every time he was talking to the Pharisees, for example, he was criticizing them. So you're right. Yahusha was anti-religious. So he says, you know, I get that.
So, Yahweh, I mean, well, we know that the third statement he makes, often called the third commandment, and
right.
It's the only one written that could actually be confused in a command form, and it's probably because he's so angry about it.
Yeah,
he says not to associate him or his reputation with religion. That's what he's saying there.
Right.
I don't care what, it isn't, thou shalt. Not take the Lord's name in vain.
You know something, Larry, I'm gonna throw out a proposal here that I don't think I've shared before, and you're feel free to disagree with it or challenge it. But there is more to that statement, Yah's third on that first tablet, than you should not mislead and promote deadly myths in my name because I will not forgive you. Actual text, if you really just get to the core of what he's saying, is that his argument here is against the negation of his name. His argument is against those who would belittle his name, for example, by removing his name from their religion, from removing his name for his from his own testimony and replacing his name with a satanic title. He says that I will never forgive. Now I want you to go one take one step further on this. In the religion
I'm
of Christianity,
right,
okay, all right. In the religion of Christianity, is Yahweh's name used?
No.
Okay. In the religion of Christianity, is Yahusha's name used, which tells us that it's Yahweh saving us?
Well, neither is his title Mashiach, or they would be calling.
So all three are replaced, and they're replaced by false names. And the religion itself, what is the religion called?
Christianity.
Right. Is it is there any reference to the covenant there?
No.
Is there any reference to Yahweh in the religion?
No.
In fact, didn't they not only remove Yahweh from their religion, but didn't they also negate his testimony in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms so that they could have Paul's gospel of grace?
Yeah, sure. They replaced the mercy in Yahweh's Torah, which is Yahusha,
Okay, now let me go one step further. All right, so that's Christianity. Christianity is in wholesale discord with Yahweh's position here, which means that there can't be a Christian that is forgiven, because that's what God says. Unequivocally, there will be no forgiveness for someone who does what Christianity has done. Now, let's look at rabbinical Judaism. Do you find Yahweh's name in rabbinical Judaism?
No, no, they're guilty of the very thing, very same thing.
Right. They call him Hashem, the name. They won't say his name. In fact, it's a crime punishable
Adonai.
By death. Right.
And Adonai.
Right, replacing his name with Adonai, which means my Lord. All right, so Judaism diminished the value of his name. In fact, the Masoretes, which are responsible for the Masoretic text that they use, the Masoretes actually came up with a system for diminishing the merit of Yahweh's name, making it impossible to pronounce.
Shoah.
Right, the Shoah system, which means to corrupt.
I mean, lifeless.
Yeah, which means, yeah, to corrupt and to be lifeless. All right, now I'm going to go the fastest growing religion, Islam. Does Islam have a refer to Yahweh by his name?
No, no.
Did they replace his name?
Yes. Well, they actually invented it.
Yeah, incredible. Right, with Allah. Yeah, replaced it with Allah. And didn't they not say that Allah is greater than any other god, meaning that their god is greater than Yahweh?
Yeah, that's
so right. So there is not a single Muslim that has been forgiven. There's not a single religious Jew that has been forgiven. There's not a single Christian that has been forgiven. So, you know, if you look at the statement that Yahweh etched in stone, you can make very dramatic statements that are at wholesale conflict with the world's perceptions. There's not a single religious person in this world who has been saved. Not one.
That's correct. And that's one of the things I was just trying to point out, is that Yahweh is vehement about not being a religious deity. He wants to be greeted as an individual. That means I walk up to him and shake his hand.
Okay, so if we were to follow the example that Yahweh and Yahusha set, and by they're really one and the same.
Right.
Okay, we've got Yahweh having second only to professing the path that leads to him, denouncing religion and politics throughout his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And we have every single encounter between Yahusha and the religious and political community with him exposing and denouncing them. So,
that's right.
Based upon that example, would it be godly or ungodly to denounce religion and politics?
It would be godly. And it would also be in line with his speaking to expose it, condemn it. And
let me ask you another question then. Since God does say that he's infinite in mercy, is it merciful, is it compassionate to expose and condemn religion?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It would be the opposite. By the way, let me just throw something else in here, since we're on the track here, that we know Yahweh's not a religious deity, and you were just talking about water. You know, Yahweh said matter and space shall exist in the midst of the waters, existing, dividing, and separating for the purposes of understanding waters in the midst of waters in relation to the waters.
Right.
He's talking about the way planets are actually developed.
Yeah, yeah.
And this
molecular water is the second only to hydrogen, is the most prevalent molecule in the universe. And so he's actually talking there about the creative process. But beyond the creative process, he's also talking about the role that water plays in our understanding of life,
eternal. And millennia later, all this he said is confirmed by science. Matter and space and time produced out of a light, Big Bang. He used that term, second line in Bereshith.
Right.
And
if you get right back to what you were saying at the beginning, if we're going to base something like, for example, baptism, which is a Greek transliteration as opposed to the Hebrew, but if we're going to base something on something happened in the Jordan, something is important relative to water, something's according to Yahusha is important symbolism associated with the water, with the Spirit in his conversation with Nicodemus. If we're going to look for the role water plays in our relationship with Yahweh and our salvation, should we not look to Yahweh's presentation of water in the Torah?
Sure. Absolutely.
And doesn't Yahweh constantly talk about the cistern of life, on how the water provides the life, how water cleanses? He has instructions in his Torah, guidance, as to how to use water for a cleansing perspective. And doesn't he, in his creation account, explain how life emerged from waters?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's really all there. And in the Torah? Doesn't Yahweh also explain the importance of crossing the Jordan? The Jordan, once you cross through the waters of the Jordan, you enter the Promised Land?
Yeah.
So why should we be surprised to find Yahusha in the Jordan at the beginning of his earthly ministry?
No need to be surprised. I just wanted to point out that what Yahweh says is true, and he's not a religious deity. And my point being that any time we're associating Yahweh with faith, which is back to what we were talking about, we're talking about religious notions. Faith in the unknown.
Here they're confessing their faith in the death of Jesus Christ. Now, so how is it that God, who is immortal, can die?
Well, he didn't. His nephesh soul was in Sheol the next day.
So if God died, why did Yahusha say before his body died on the cross, and the body is different, God's not a physical body, before his body died as the Passover lamb, why did he say, my God, why have you forsaken me? To forsake means to leave, to desert. So God left him at that point because, God can't die, folks. And it's amazing that Christians can't process that testimony. During Miss, we have Larry with us, and we're considering the 15th edict of really Christianity at large, but specifically stated by the Seventh-day Adventists, and they wrote, by baptism we confess our faith in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We've already explained that there is no Jesus, there is no Christ. There is a Messiah, Yahusha, but if you don't know his name or his title, you most certainly don't know him. Well, we've dealt with the death, the fact that God can't die. And so this Christian focus on death is ghoulish and ridiculous. But resurrection, bodily resurrection, Larry, can you tell me what the one common denominator is amongst the three scenes that are witnessed to on the first fruits, on Bukodim, the firstborn children, when Yahusha's soul emerges from Sheol and Yah and is reunited with Yahweh's spirit? There's one common denominator in the three eyewitness accounts on that day.
I know what
was
that
it?
Is.
Yeah.
They didn't recognize him.
Correct. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, even at the end of his final stay, when he's going back and forth between heaven and earth, and he joins his disciples, he joins the boys for a breakfast. And he shows up at breakfast with his disciples. Now, they've all seen him walk through a wall, so he's not a normal body anymore. They don't recognize him at the breakfast.
He's not a Shaolin priest. So
right.
He's not been able to do that.
Right. So they didn't even recognize him when he showed up for breakfast during his final 30 or 40 days with them. They didn't even recognize him then. So if the point of that Yahusha was trying to make is that you can kill God, but God can come back bodily to life, and therefore you should place your faith in this Christian religion. Wouldn't the single most important point that he would want to prove is that when he rose from the dead bodily, that everyone recognized him and said, ooh, he rose from the dead bodily. And wouldn't you expect the opposite of what you read in the eyewitness accounts, that no one recognizes, not his mother, not the women in his life, not the disciples, not the two guys that had witnessed what he was doing on the road to Emmaus? Nobody. So what we're dealing with here is the eyewitness accounts destroy the single most important element of Christianity, if Christianity is to be believed. As does Yahusha's testimony. My God, why have you forsaken me? Which is a direct citation out of the 22nd Psalm, telling us where we should turn if we want a real eyewitness account of what was occurring here. Where he says, I'm no longer, God's no longer here. God can't die. It's astonishing, and they continue to promote it as if it were true when their own text negated. You know, it's interesting, of course, is the death of Christ is, they say, is equivalent to the death of sin in them, their death of sin. So do you think that there is such a thing that you confess faith and all of a sudden you're dead to sin? When you elected to join the covenant, Larry, did you become perfect?
Well, yeah, I did in Yahweh's eyes.
How about in your wife's eyes? How about in your wife's eyes?
No.
And the same thing is true for me. I became perfect from Yahweh's eyes, which is really all that really matters to me. Well, it does not. No, I would like my wife to view me as good, too. But, I mean, I'm still a flawed individual. And the point there, of course, is the most beloved individual for Yahweh is David. And he continued to be quite flawed as a human. But his relationship with Yahweh was perfect because he knew how to observe the Torah. And so we don't die to sin. Sin doesn't die in us. Yahweh covers us in a garment of light, and our sin just becomes invisible to God. That's why God can't be all-knowing, because he does not know, has no recollection of anything that we have done that is wrong. That's why we are able to enter his home, looking perfect.
Well, there's all kinds of Christians out there that have been, you know, like the serial killers, like BTK. You got Jeffrey Dahmer. He was raised in a good Christian household.
Yeah.
Professed Christianity. He was a cannibal out living dead bodies.
Well, of course, in Roman Catholicism, this next point, which is point 16, the Lord's Supper. Yeah, isn't the Eucharist based upon this myth that the Roman Catholic priest turns the wine into blood, and they turn the wafer into the body of their mythological God, Jesus Christ?
Yep.
And what did God say about cannibalism?
That's a no-go. It's a non-starter.
Don't go there. What did he say about blood?
Don't drink it.
Don't drink it. So the Roman Catholic position is wholly and completely the antithesis of what God said. And by the way, God didn't say, I'm turning this wine into blood. I'm turning this yeasted wafer into my flesh. He's making a connection.